You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Episode 9. Don and Tom, True Religion. How Don's reign as the king of the blockbuster gave Don free reign to indulge in every vice imaginable. That's a long title to describe Don's wild ride between making Top Gun and making Days of Thunder. The movie where more than 50 $100,000 race cars were crashed in production, a production that would set in motion Don's own personal and career crash, a crash that would see him fall into a six-year period of despair and addiction from which he would never recover. Now, a shorter title for this episode might have been Cocaine and Call Girls, which is what Don was primarily focused on after another blockbuster success, Beverly Hills Cop 2. There was cocaine on movie sets. There was cocaine delivered to his office by limo drivers. There was cocaine to tip valet drivers and bribe car dealerships into bumping his name up to the top of the list to be the first guy in town to get that new black Ferrari Testarossa. How could everybody in town not know Don was a coke addict? And yet, nobody in town thought to say, "Hey, Don, maybe you shouldn't be doing lines at your desk in the middle of an interview with a writer for Esquire." Or, "Hey, Don, you've crashed another sports car while you were coked out of your brain. Maybe it's time to stop before you kill somebody." But no, nobody said a word. Not as long as Don was making $300 million in gross domestic on budgets of $15 million. As long as the money was pouring in, Don could do as he pleased. Pierce's friend, the film historian David Thompson, summed it up best.
"The average Hollywood tycoon prefers to be discreet about such plunder. But Don was an animal, and the suave masters in silk suits were tickled that he was so naked, so acting out with it. What he meant by that, I suppose, was that the deal makers and the executives and the shareholders and all the rest who determined who could and who could not make movies were very much entertained by Don's behaviour. They enjoyed it, even encouraged it. In their minds, Don was a Hollywood legend, and they were, as David said, tickled to be part of the vice and scandal and, yes, even the tragedy, I'm afraid. In every decade, there seems to be some Hollywood character who would live on in infamy. In the 1980s, it was Don."
Pierce would often say how Don's life was a Siddhartha story in the William Blake poem, "Where the Road of Excess Led to the Palace of Wisdom." Well, in episode 9, Don is right smack dab in the middle of the road to excess part of our story.
Lieutenant John Simpkin, a former Top Gun, was a consultant to the movie's producers.
"Well, our goal was to make it so as realistic as we possibly could, so when people go up there and they see those airplanes, they know there's no special effects. Those airplanes flying are real airplanes, and there's real pilots flying them."
The actor spent most of the time in a simulated cockpit, but for initiation, they were taken up and shaken up. It was nothing like co-star Anthony Edwards had ever experienced.
"You know, I was just hanging on to survive, and so a lot of the dialogue that we shot up there is completely useless because most of it was like, 'Help! Oh my God!'"
The world premiere could boost San Diego's image as a movie-making location, but the night really belonged to the Navy.
"It's supposed to be about the guys that have to do a job that calls for them to make it safe for America to sleep at night.
This movie may even help recruiting. It was a chance for the Navy to show off what Top Gun really means.
Top Gun did what no movie in the history of the movie business had ever done. It had turned thousands of moviegoers into military recruits. The Navy saw a 500% increase in applications from young men who wanted to become naval aviators and wear Ray-Bans like Tom Cruise. Recruiting had been part of Don's pitch to the Pentagon. But even Don couldn't have imagined that so many young men would walk out of his movie and enter into a career they knew nothing about, other than watching Tom Cruise flying F-14s. And it wasn't just the theater experience. People were seeing the movie two and three times in the theaters and then going out and buying the VHS tape. At that time, $80 to $90 was a typical price for a new VHS release. With such high demands from young teenage boys badgering their parents, Paramount would lower the price to $26. They would sell a record 3 million tapes. Top Gun would forever change the VHS market.
The success of the movie actually pulled Tom and Don apart in the end. Tom wanted to be taken seriously as an actor, and Don, well, Don wanted to be taken seriously as the most successful producer in the universe. To that end, I guess they both succeeded.
In terms of quality of work, Tom really stepped it up. Paul Newman and Martin Scorsese in the remake of The Hustler, opposite Dustin Hoffman in the Academy Award-nominated Rain Man. His own Academy Award nomination playing paraplegic Vietnam vet Ron Kovac in Born on the 4th of July. It was a rapid transformation from teen boy idol to award-winning actor. He would also fall in love, get married, and find religion in the Church of Scientology. He was just 26 years old. As for Don wanting to follow Tom's lead in working on a Martin Scorsese movie, Don didn't work for auteurs. Because Don was his own auteur, Don's movies could only be Don Simpson movies. He was the only producer in the world who could take a one-sentence idea and spin it into millions of dollars. And after Top Gun, everybody in town wanted to know, what was Don's next big idea?
Don had this idea book that he carried around with him everywhere. I remember there was this one particular car crash where Don needed a ride home. He had swerved off a windy strip on Mulholland near Jack Nicholson's house. He couldn't call Jack, so he called me. His Ferrari was stuck into the side of a UCLA heart surgeon's garage. We were all worried his car might actually blow up the way it was hissing steam off the engine. Don and a lady friend of his, Miss November named Catherine St. John, if I recall, were safely in my rental car. But as we were driving away, Don suddenly screamed at me to pull over. I said, "Don, you can't go back to your car. It's going to blow, for God's sake." It was quite the sight. Don running down Mulholland Drive in the early morning fog. It was so thick he actually disappeared for a moment. He dove into his car, which was now starting to sputter and spit out all sorts of fumes, and wedging his torso through the door window because, well, the door was too bent to open, he found what he was looking for in the glove box. And, quite out of breath, he staggered back to me and Catherine. "What was it, Don? What was in the car?" The notebook. It had every idea Don had jotted down over the last 5 years. Don called it the billion-dollar book. And it was precious. All of his thoughts and ideas. And more valuable than all of Don's sports cars and real estate properties combined.
Don's next big idea. Everyone in town was anxious to see how Don would once again defy expectations.
"What are you doing in a place like this?"
"What are you talking about? Place like what?"
"Place like this. Swimming pool, jacuzzi."
"What are you talking about? I'm spoiling myself rotten."
"Oh, you mean the construction that's going on? Yes, I'm very embarrassed about that. What I'm trying to do, though, is just confine myself to the other five bedrooms. I'm used to compromising my lifestyle."
"Bullshit. You've stolen this house."
"How the fuck can you steal a house? This is my uncle's house."
"Is he in rock and roll?"
"No. Well, look at the big titties. Yo, man, look at this. Titties, orange juice, beer. Will you go put your trunks on and get in this pool?"
With a second Beverly Hills Cop movie, Don would indeed defy expectations in doing the one thing he vowed he would never do, make a sequel of one of his own movies. For 10 years, Don was the idea man. If I can see it, I can make it.
Don came up with ideas. He didn't do sequels. But working once again with Eddie Murphy, and more importantly, telling everyone that he was again working with Eddie Murphy, trumped Don's golden rule.
The question wasn't why, but why not? I mean, why not put Eddie Murphy in another action comedy where he has to solve a crime and do his signature fast-talking shtick? A sequel would be just the beginning. We'd see Axel in Tokyo, Axel in London, Axel in Paris. A fish-out-of-water detective taking on the local cops while stopping the bad guys with his street smarts and sharp wit. Plug and play. New city, same formula. This was a franchise.
I have the money and I do want to do business, but with you, I ain't doing nothing in front of this dude because this dude is a cop. I know when I can smell a pig inside the room. I used to be a Muslim, man, and I know that's Park over here. Yes, Park. It's definitely Park. I ain't doing shit around this dude, man. You want to do business? You know where to find me. Fuck you, man. Allahu Akbar.
You calling me a cop? Come here, dude. Come here.
And what would Don call part two of his soon-to-be blockbuster franchise? Beverly Hills Cop 2. Don was known as a title guy. Days of Thunder, Crimson Tide. When marketing was desperate to find a new title for their film, My Posse Don't Do Homework, Don, who at that time was holed up in Hawaii hooked on pharmaceuticals, managed to come up with the title Dangerous Minds. In this case, Don's state of mind was one of clear, assured confidence. Titles? Who needs them? This movie, the Beverly Hills Cop sequel, would be so big it wouldn't need a new title. And Don was right. Beverly Hills Cop 2 was the big event movie of 1987. The box office would once again crack $300 million. Even when Don took his foot off the gas, he could still deliver a hit movie. Remember that quote from journalist John Taylor who argued that the two most influential people of the 1980s were Ronald Reagan and Don Simpson? At that moment, in 1987, it would be hard to make a case against it. Now, unlike President Reagan, Don had no ambitions to run for political office. But like Reagan, movies weren't enough. They were a means to an end. Reagan delved into politics, and Don delved into...
Well... He created a one-man black market network of sex and drugs that could only have flourished in Los Angeles in the 1980s.
Don cared as much about his after-hours activities as he did his day job. He had detailed lists of call girls and drug dealers, and he hired assistants whose sole purpose was to procure what he needed.
I can recall one tale of a young man who was trying to break into the industry who interviewed with Don. Don told him the job requirements were to travel with him internationally to procure drugs and call girls. The young man was stunned. Don, I'm sorry, are you asking me to be your pimp and drug dealer? Just when I'm overseas, Don responded, I've got that position filled here in the United States.
For Don, Hollywood had gotten boring. A night on the town was a screening or a work dinner. Most of his colleagues were just trying to get home to tuck their kids into bed. Don lived for the night, where any sinister and nefarious transgression could manifest behind his gated walls.
Let me also just emphasize something, okay? Don took this world very, very seriously. One could imagine how chaotic and out of control a traveling party of cool girls and drug dealers and cocaine addicts might have been. But for Don, it was always a controlled chaos. He was always very serious about his vice. He needed to control this environment as much as he aspired to assert control over his movies.
This theme of control was Don's great paradox. Live a life of decadence and chaos while bringing absolute order to such chaos. There was a Howard Hughes sort of obsessiveness to Don's nocturnal madness. The last days of Scorsese's The Aviator were not unlike Don's final days of isolation.
He is to open the bag with his right hand and hold the bag out to me at a 45-degree angle so I may reach into the bag without touching the paper. If there is any variation of these instructions, even to the smallest degree, the entire process must be repeated from the beginning.
Don tried to keep his life on temperature control for over 20 years. And as you can imagine, there were times when the thermostat was broken, when things just got too hot and the mercury spilt over. And in those moments, when the fun and games were over and the players passed out in the bedrooms in Don's massive concrete mansion, Don was left with nothing. Nothing but himself to contend with in the silence of his own horrible self-loathing.
In her book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience of Addiction, former addict and neuroscientist Judith Greisel writes that the unfortunate bottom line of all regular drug use is that there is no such thing as a free lunch. All drugs act on the brain in a way that diminishes their enjoyable effects and creates unpleasant ones with repeated use. Now, imagine that repeated use ongoing for over 20 years. We mentioned that Don went to rehab during Top Gun. These were cushy Malibu rehabs. They offered a luxury stay and a retreat from life's troubles. They would coddle Don, charging him exorbitant amounts until he demonstrated some short-term sobriety, after which he would inevitably relapse, and the cycle would continue. Finally, Don had had enough. He had heard of addicts foregoing rehab for a new kind of treatment. They found it in the Church of Scientology. When we return, a look at Don's connection to Tom Cruise and the Church of Scientology.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In Scientology, we use the word thetan. The term thetan is taken from the Greek letter theta, which has long served as a symbol for thought or spirit. We use thetan to avoid confusions with other concepts and beliefs regarding the soul or spirit. It isn't something you have. You wouldn't say, my thetan. You'd simply say, me. You have a body. You have a mind. You are a thetan.
It was in Scientology that Don and Tom Cruise would once again intersect. To understand Tom's connection to Scientology and Don's interest in the religion, it's important to know the story of one of Scientology's youngest members. Her name was Miriam Schickler. Miriam Schickler was, by all accounts, a beautiful and highly intelligent teenage girl. Top of her class, high marks in science, photographic memory. Product of her divorce, she would live with her father, a civil engineer whose job required the family to move around a lot. Like Tom, she would attend many schools. Because of her academic brilliance, she was able to skip grades, and she graduated high school at the age of 14. She would go to work for her dad at a casino in Lake Tahoe. He had given up his civil engineering career and had become a professional gambler. Miriam, with her high IQ and disarming beauty, became something of a prodigy poker and blackjack player. By this time, Miriam's father had given up his Jewish faith and joined a new religion, the Church of Scientology. This was the 1960s, a time when L. Ron Hubbard's teachings really struck a chord with many disillusioned hippies and Vietnam vets dissatisfied with what was happening in America.
The average man is up against certain problems. He's asking himself certain questions. How can I make more money? How can I make my wife faithful to me? How can I make my children grow up? How can, in other words, how can I live a better life? How can I make things more more stable for my family. How could, you know, how? And what am I up against? What is happening to me in my life? What is my purpose in life? And so forth. These questions, in actual fact, absorb a tremendous quantity of his energy. And he himself is not able to go out and do anything very progressive about it. So the best thing for him to do is to go out and do something about it. But he can't do anything about it because he is so immersed in this. So actually, in Scientology processing, he resolves these questions. He understands what he's doing. He knows what he wants to do. And he makes up his mind and he goes ahead and does it. And he turns from a man who is simply a puzzled, static being into somebody who is more dynamic, who is able to accomplish something.
For Miriam's father, who had long been dissatisfied with his career choices, the church was a chance to join a movement. It was also a chance to make a living. Hubbard had created a fast food franchise model of Scientology centers, and Miriam's father took over one of the franchises. Miriam would soon join him. She soon became a top-tier auditor. An auditor was a church member assigned to ask a new parishioner, known as a pre-clear, a series of questions. At the end of the session, the auditor will have cleared the pre-clear of their traumatic memory, and they will become a Thetan, in effect, becoming a member of the church. Miriam was such an effective auditor that she was given permission to train the top-tier Scientologists. She was all of 16 years old. At 21, she moved to Los Angeles. She would join Operation Celebrity. This was the Scientology project to bring in as many wealthy celebrities as possible. She married a fellow Scientologist named Jim Rogers. They would open up a franchise, or mission, as it was called, in Sherman Oaks. And Miriam, who was smart and beautiful with a photographic memory, and now well-connected in LA's celebrity scene, started to find success as an actor. Her marriage would fall apart the next few years, but her career was on the rise. At this point, she would change her name from Miriam to the stage name Mimi, and take her ex-husband's name, Rogers. It was at a party in Los Angeles when 21-year-old Tom Cruise met the older and wiser beyond her years, Mimi Rogers. Top Gun was still in development. Tom was spending his days with Don working on the script. Tom was uncertain about its prospects and still battle-scarred from doing the film legend. He needed support and he needed structure. Spending long nights with a party animal like Don wasn't going to give him the foundation that he was seeking. Mimi introduced him to the church. At a time when Tom was looking for a process, a life philosophy, a way to live. It's important to note that the church at this time was in disarray. L. Ron Hubbard passed away in 1986, just around the time that Mimi had taken Tom into the church.
Several of my reporter friends had actually done a fair bit of investigation around Scientology. The church back then was very private, very closed, very secretive. They even had their own private intelligence agency.
Operation Snow White. That was the code name for Hubbard's private Scientology intelligence agency's spy scheme to infiltrate the federal government. They even had a dossier on President Nixon. The FBI would launch raids on Scientology centers across the country. 11 Scientologists were arrested, including L. Ron's wife, Mary Sue Hubbard. The charges stem from wiretapping to burglary to targeting government buildings, including the IRS and the Deputy Attorney General's office. L. Ron would go into hiding. On the run from tax evasion, he was said to be living under an assumed name on a ranch in Creston, California. It was there that he would write his novel, Battlefield Earth. A film would later be made starring John Travolta. And what a film it was.
Well, I can assure you that I was not groomed since birth to have some cushy job that even a moron like you could perform. While you were still learning how to spell your name, I was being trained to conquer galaxies.
L. Ron would also record an album with an all-star cast of friends, including Travolta, Frank Stallone, Chick Corea, Leif Garrett, and Karen Black. L. Ron can be heard singing on the final track, L'Envoi, Thank You for Listening.
But truth is truth, and if they then decide to live with lies, that's their concern, not mine, my friend. They're free to fantasize.
Soon after the recording, Hubbard's body would be found in a motorhome tucked behind the animal stables on his ranch. There was no family there. His wife was still in prison, and his estranged son was thought to be dead. In the days following, Hubbard's successor, David Miscavige, would address grieving members of the church in a packed auditorium. Members were not told that L. Ron Hubbard had died, but rather that L. Ron had discarded the body he had used in his lifetime, and that now he would continue his quest into the most advanced levels as an OT, an operating phaeton. Members were reported to have broken out into rapturous applause. From that day forward, Miscavige assumed complete power and authority over the church, and his new best friend and most powerful ally would be Tom Cruise.
It was around that time that Don had got curious about the Sea Org.
The Sea Org, Scientology's most powerful faction. They lived in an exclusive international base, a compound of 50 buildings, heavily guarded with high walls and barbed wire to prevent escape. They had come into light after Hubbard died. There was a purported coup, ousting Hubbard's lieutenants, and David Miscavige took charge.
The yacht was where Don had heard you could develop a resistance to WOG illness. A WOG is what the church called the common man, or anyone not involved in the church. Now, Don had more than a few WOG illnesses. Most serious were his WOG addictions, food, sex, and drugs. Rehab hadn't worked for him, so why not try the church?
Don fell out of Scientology for the very reasons that he sought it out. He was too undisciplined, too restless, too indulgent to follow any sort of rigorous transformational path.
The essence of the religion is for members to identify and clear away any and all past trauma. That didn't exactly sit well with Don. Don wanted to hold on to his trauma. He wore it like a badge. It gave him his edge, you know? The bad boy producer with a troubled past. That was his narrative.
In the end, Don felt he couldn't be a bad boy producer making his high-octane movies if he was cured of his bad boy behavior. And nobody in the film business was going to tell Don to knock it off. Nobody, that is, except his personal secretary. When we return, Don's secretary seeks revenge, and Don lawyers up.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
At the time, there were secretaries and there were assistants. Assistants were supposed to be set up for promotion and a career path in the business. An executive secretary was more of a revolving door job. You did it for as long as you could, and then you hoped to latch on to another powerful white male CEO that could offer you a better salary. Monica Harmon had no illusions of advancing in the film business, and in some ways, this made her more of a determined plaintiff. She had nothing to lose. Harmon files a complaint for $2.5 million in damages, claiming emotional distress. Don's legal team files a cross-complaint for $5 million, claiming that Harmon invaded Don's privacy by searching wastebaskets and files for confidential documents that could insinuate Don's cocaine use, even though Harmon hadn't filed a claim insinuating Don's cocaine use. Harmon's claim gets tossed out of court. Harmon files a new complaint, and this time she doesn't hold back. In the suit, she claims Don called her obscene and demeaning names, including garbage brain, and that he was often drunk or on drugs during this abusive behavior. Worse, Harmon claims, is that Don asked her to clean up his cocaine crumbs that she said Don would leave on tables and desks around the offices. And even worse, she claimed Don asked that beyond her secretary duties, she maintain a list of call girls and schedule Don's dates. Don's team, led by super lawyer Bertram Fields and Fields' go-to gumshoe, Anthony Pelicano, were brought on to file a countersuit.
Bert Fields was the most brilliant and the most feared lawyer in town. Mario Puzo called him the great consigliere. He was regal and dignified, and every power player in town wanted his counsel.
In his spare time, he was a novelist and a historian with an expertise on the matter of Shakespeare's authenticity as the author of his plays.
He left a will that was so precise that he left his second best bed to his wife. And yet, he doesn't mention one book. He doesn't mention any literary property. He doesn't talk about unpublished plays. Isn't that amazing for a guy who had this body of work? When you look at the people who ran theaters at the time, you will not find a payment for a play to William Shakespeare. He's paid as an actor, but he's not paid. Other playwrights are paid. Why?
And then there was Fields' wildly feared Sicilian private eye, Anthony Pelicano. Pelicano had once been accused by entertainment reporter Anita Bush of leaving a dead fish on her windshield, a warning that if Bush didn't stop writing about one of Pelicano's clients, Bush would, according to Sicilian mafia lore, sleep with the fishes.
Tony Pelicano was brilliant. You know that film, The Conversation with Gene Hackman, all about wiretapping? Well, Tony was that character. He actually invented some of that technology. His electronic surveillance dated back to the Kennedy administration. When you mix Tony's surveillance expertise with his showmanship and the tough-talking guarantees that he was known for, you can see why Burt Fields and Tom Cruise hired him.
So what did Fields and Pelicano dig up? For starters, they found that Harmon had used cocaine several times during her tenure with Don, and that she had rented sexually explicit tapes for home viewing, and that she had been to a famous male stripper nightclub, Chippendales, several times. It was a character assassination, and Harmon wanted no part of it. One rather obvious question was, why didn't Harmon report Don to HR? And if she did, why didn't Paramount protect her? Harmon later stated she feared telling Paramount about Don's cocaine use. But she did claim, on several occasions, to have notified the studio of what she described as Don's illegal and moral demands. Paramount would issue a one-line response stating that company policy prohibited comment on any pending litigation. Now, HR at Paramount in 1987 isn't the same as HR today. Back then, any claims, if there were any claims against Don, would likely have been buried under the proverbial rug. A woman in her position didn't stand a chance. The Harmon case was nothing more than a minor nuisance for Don. He would continue to drink as much whiskey and snort as much blow at the workplace as he desired. In the end, the Harmon case was a hiccup at most in Don's joyride to enjoy the spoils of his many victories. Don was riding high, figuratively and literally. Nothing would slow him down. Not his car crashes, not his madam's arrest by LAPD, not his ill-fated time in Scientology, and certainly not the HR department at Paramount. No, the only thing that would slow down Don was Don. The Don Season 2 is executive produced by Will McCormick and David Harris Klein. Klein also wrote and created the series. Mike Jurisitz is the editor, sound designer, and producer of the series. The podcast is produced and narrated by Malaya Rivera-Drew. That's me. Louis Weymouth voices the character of Pierce and also produces the series. For more episodes of The Don Season 2, listen to the series on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.